Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org. Well, hello, and welcome to this week's Nature Now program. I'm Nan Evans, your host, and my guest this week is Dr. Ian Miller. Ian is the Coastal Hazards Specialist for the Washington Sea Grant and is based in Port Angeles, Washington. We are speaking with him today remotely. If you look up Dr. Ian Miller in Google, which I have done recently, you find that he is absolutely a multifaceted person. He's a solid scientific researcher. He's got expertise in things like beach erosion, other changes to beaches, coastal sediment transport, geomorphology, which is a fancy name for structure and landforms. He also is very knowledgeable in coastal flooding issues and in Washington coastal ecology in general. Well, and not only is he a respected scientist, but he has also been a really valued advisor to a number of coastal communities, tribes, and public entities in Washington State with the, and I think I can say this for Ian, with the express goal of focusing on sea level rise and sea level rise related hazard assessments. And then mostly with the focus on problem solving and the management applications that that kind of knowledge might give communities. And speaking of communities, one of the goals of Ian's work seems to be strengthening communities as they try to plan for and manage coastal hazards, which of course includes tsunamis, chronic erosion, coastal flooding, and lots of other hazards associated with climate change. I also want to say, according to Google, and I trusted on this one, Ian is a very committed individual in communication, outreach, education, applied research, and trying to synthesize science with what communities can do or could do or the kind of information they need to understand to have a future in our changing world. Ian is also a member of the North Pacific Coast Marine Resources Committee, and Ian is one of the key organizers of the River and Ocean Film Festival, which is held annually in Forks. And we'll talk more about that in a minute. Ian, welcome to Nature Now. Before we talk further with Ian, let's hear this week's mystery sound. You want a little hint? Well, this is a creature with attitude, big attitude. And I've actually been hearing this creature very regularly and loudly outside my house. And I will admit that sometimes its variety of calls can fake me out a little bit. I'll bet a lot of you know what it is too. And towards the end of the program, we'll play it again and reveal the identity. I should share that I first learned about Ian Miller's work, and it was about a decade ago. I was a planning commissioner for the city of Port Townsend. We were at the time working on the comp plan revision, and I really became interested in how climate change and sea level rise could affect the shores of the Olympic Peninsula. And today, a decade later, I'm talking for the first time with Ian. So, Ian, would you share a bit with listeners about the recent Washington sea level rise assessment that you led and about your work in the collaborative development of comprehensive climate change vulnerability assessments? Is that the right phrase?
It can be, yeah.
And with lots of local tribes, local governments, and special districts. Again, give us a preview of that kind of work.
Yeah, sure. And first, let me say thank you for having me on the show. So a big part of my work is indeed focused on trying to work out all of the ways that we can try to enhance what we refer to as resilience, just the notion in coastal communities in Washington. So just the idea that we are prepared for whatever stressors may be coming our way in the future. I'm particularly focused on those that are associated with natural hazards, so things like flooding and erosion, And those are exacerbated by sea level rise. Mm-hmm. And so that indeed has become a big focus of mine over the last 15 years, as you mentioned. A lot of the early work was associated with what I'm going to characterize as the simple problem of figuring out how high will the ocean get by when and where.
A simple but very complex problem, I would think.
Complex in Washington, because we live in a very tectonically active area. And so a lot of what we expect to happen in regards to the level of the ocean in any particular community is actually structured by what the land is doing. So we've invested a lot of especially early effort on understanding coastal vertical land movement. I'm saying we because it's not only me. There's a whole group of collaborators and partners that I've worked with over the years. The interest there is in understanding what we call coastal vertical land movement. How fast is the land at the coast going up or down because of this tectonic deformation that's part of the landscape that we live in?
Yeah, and that's something we don't think about a lot, that it does go in some areas up and in some areas down, all due to the shifting of plates and all the geologic activity.
Yeah, and so what that means from a sea level rise standpoint is what a particular community experiences is sort of a function or a result of both how the ocean level is changing, but also how the land level that their community is built on is changing. So we put a lot of emphasis on trying to understand those patterns. That was a big feature of some of the early work that I did, trying to better communicate and convey possible future sea level outcomes. And there's a lot of uncertainty in those. All climate change, what we call projections, have a lot of uncertainty to them, especially as you move further and further out in time. And that uncertainty is not surprisingly a challenge for planning. And so it would be ideal if, you know, we knew exactly what was going to happen in 2100, but we don't. And so we have these, you know, the approach that's used is to project the future, making some assumptions about a whole variety of things. And so communicating that uncertainty was another feature of what we did.
And can you really make site-specific projections, given the uncertainty, but just projections that are site-specific now?
Yes. I mean, that's effectively what it was a main feature of. I think you referenced some work that I was part of as part of what we called the Washington Coastal Resilience Project. This was a NOAA-funded, Washington-focused initiative that led to the publication of very localized sea level rise projections for Washington's communities. It's available currently as an interactive website where someone can go online, pick their location, and get sort of a set of customized sea level projections for their site.
Yeah, and I certainly have seen those, you know, obviously for Port Townsend.
Yeah.
It is fascinating. For an interested listener, how do they find that website?
The best thing to do is just to Google Washington Sea Level Rise Interactive, and it'll be the first link that you find.
Okay, that's easy enough.
Almost certainly, it's housed on the Climate Impacts Group website, which is a University of Washington group that is sort of a go-to for a lot of climate impacts information. One of the things that is an important feature of this work and this world is that projections are updated and change as time goes on. Mm-hmm. We're trying to understand the future, and part of understanding the future is understanding what has happened in the intervening roughly 10 years since we published those. Mm-hmm. And our understanding of the processes that lead to sea level change changes. The observations that we make inform what to expect in the future. And so we should always expect that those will be updated. And in fact, we are in the process of updating those projections for Washington State. So that's also something that listeners can look forward to in the next, hopefully, year. There should be sort of a new set that we can point Washington State coastal communities to.
And I'm also excited by the notion of sort of seeing science in action. Observations change over time. Theories get tested and improved. That's what I like about science.
Very much so,
things change and you learn more and more. I do want to ask you to touch on one other subject that I know you've done a great deal of work on, and that's nearshore restoration projects, and specifically the restoration of the coastline, the delta, the shore of the Elwha River, which of course is famous in our neck of the woods for the dams removal that happened, I'm thinking maybe 10-ish years ago, and a lot changed after that. Can you share some of the highlights of that work?
Oh my goodness, there are so many. Yeah, so I was very fortunate to be part of this kind of ad hoc group of researchers that connected themselves to the ELWA with a focus on trying to understand the entire suite of implication of the removal of two dams on that river, which happened between roughly 2011 and 2015. So just over 10 years ago. And a lot of my work has been focused on just really tracking and interpreting and understanding the response of the physical shoreline. So mm-hmm. the shape and characteristics of the shoreline and how those change through time. And then also the implications for the coastal ecosystem that the ELWA River empties into. One of the things that I think I, along with a lot of partners and collaborators, are kind of focused on right now is after the dam removal, there was a massive deposit of sediment mm-hmm. that built up around the mouth of the ELWA River. It formed essentially a new landscape that reached its peak in terms of area right around the end of the dam removal, 2015 or 16.
Yeah, I remember there being out there around that time.
Yeah, just there was this extensive new delta area. In the 10 years since that time, largely we've been tracking how that kind of new delta area evolves and changes with an expectation that it would. The Strait of Juan de Fuca is a very dynamic water body. And so the sediment that built up around the mouth of the ELWA River, not surprisingly, has been redistributed and moved around in the intervening 10 years. And so the big stories that we're sort of tracking right now are a lot of that material that was deposited right at the river mouth has eroded away. So that big river mouth deposit, a lot of that's actually gone at this point. And in fact, there are parts of that shoreline where erosion has reemerged as a coastal management problem. So there are places, for example, especially near the river mouth, where prior to dam removal, they were of concern because of erosion. That shoreline was bumped out by dam removal, but we've now reached the point about 10 years later where there's starting to be some erosion problems that are reemerging. Basically, the shoreline has gone back to where it was before dam removal, and it's starting to eat into basically places that are developed. Meanwhile, both to the east and west of the river mouth, we're still watching basically the dam removal response play out. So Eddie's Hook, for example, has dam removal sediment that's still moving along it and sort of changing the coastal characteristics of Eddie's Hook. And similarly to the west into Freshwater Bay, the same thing is happening.
Oh,
so, you know, I think that the dam removal is along the shoreline is this long-term propagating story. And that's something that we're still kind of watching and trying to understand. And so that's quite interesting. And some of the work that we did early on, most of which has kind of been completed and we've published results and done all the science things that we do, was associated with the influence of the finest sediments that mm-hmm. were released during dam removal. Those are the sediments that at least far from the river mouth, like around Salt Creek, for example,
right.
might have had an ecological impact. Yeah. Because those fine sediments travel pretty readily in the water. Mm-hmm. They can travel far afield. And in fact, we were able to measure ecological change associated with those fine sediments across the entire, what we refer to as the ELWA drift cell, all the way from Freshwater Bay to the base of Eddie's Hook, actually in the composition of things that lived in the shallow ocean along that stretch. So those fine sediments can definitely have some ecological implications pretty far from the river mouth.
But I want to move listeners on to another aspect of your work that is striking and it's important, and that is your very strong commitment to communication and education. And I think, of course, that makes Washington Sea Grant a really great fit for the kind of work you're doing. Can you share why you believe that scientists need to be able to communicate effectively with non-scientists?
Let me say that I believe that for myself. I think I have nuanced feelings about the demands on science in general, right? Mm-hmm. because there are a number of communication strategies that all scientists engage in, right? There are a lot of tried and true systems in place. I mean, publication is a communication strategy. Mm-hmm. It's not one that is typically very effective for reaching non-scientists, but it is a communication strategy.
And there certainly are publications that are accessible to the non-scientists that carry solid science.
Yeah. But in our case, I mean, I work for Washington Sea Grant. Washington Sea Grant is a congressionally formed, we were formed by an act of Congress. Every coastal state has a Sea Grant program, including the Great Lakes. We are designed to be an extension program. So we are designed specifically to try to make those connections between especially federal and academic science and coastal communities that can use that information to assist in managing any number of coastal stressors. So, you know, Sea Grant got its start as a more or less focused on fisheries and trying to improve commercial fisheries. And then over time has evolved into a whole lot of other areas. We have folks that work on aquaculture and water quality and invasive species. The team that I work with focuses again on this idea of coastal resilience. How do we prepare communities for the stressors that they may face from, primarily in our case, hazards? And so that is all about trying to make these connections between this scientific endeavor out there that sometimes has its own language, its own way of doing things and communicating, and then understanding the ways that the communities that we work with can use that information and trying to make those links, however they may be made. You know, in my particular case, I also have a personal background that I feel like helps me in the sense that before I went back to graduate school to really sort of dive deep into that world of science, I spent a lot of years as an educator, as a field science educator, primarily working with youth, middle schoolers mostly. And the experiences that I had in that realm, I think, really informed how I think about communication. And so I lean on that experience all the time.
I appreciate your making the distinction between the kind of work you do and perhaps the kind of work a different kind of research scientist does. But in the kind of work that you do, are there specific challenges that you can share with us?
Well, certainly. There are a number of them. You know, I think specifically associated with, let's say, the big portion of my work focused on climate change and coastal hazards that are related to climate change. There are any number of challenges associated with doing that span from just the sort of difficulties characterizing uncertainty, the difficulty in trying to understand what the future may hold. Those are kind of scientific problems in a way, but they're big ones. Mm-hmm. I mean, that sort of frames the management and communication challenges that we have when we're trying to interact with coastal communities about these problems, because there is uncertainty, because we are trying to look into the future and try to understand things that we sort of expect to happen because of climate change, but for which there is no precedent now. Those are very difficult things to ask people to try to wrap their brains around and plan for and invest in.
And then it changes over time. What is someone's expectation? This information will change.
Yeah. And then, you know, we're also trying to link that with the management environment in which communities in Washington operate. Mm-hmm. So cities and counties, for example, work under a different management realm than tribes. And so we have to understand that and try to figure out where and how we make the appropriate connections. That's a challenge in and of itself.
So this is long lead up to the River and Ocean Film Festival that I know you're very intensely involved in. It's the River and Ocean Film Festival. It's located at the Rainforest Arts Center in Forks, Washington, out on the Outer Coast. And it will be occurring on October the 2nd. It's free and family friendly. I was taken a bit by some of the promotional information, which describes the film festival as an exploration of the natural and social dimensions of the coast and coastal watersheds of the Olympic Peninsula. So, Ian, how did you get involved in this?
Thank you for highlighting the film festival, by the way. It's great to be able to talk about it. So the film festival emerged in 2014, shortly after, you know, I started to engage with the North Pacific Coast Marine Resources Committee, shortly after I started with Sea Grant, so around 2012. Marine Resources Committees are designed to be these county-based groups of engaged citizens that are supposed to do a variety of things. They typically have some funding that they distribute for projects that can occur in their jurisdiction. In some cases, advise county commissions or counties in general on marine issues relative to their county. And then they're there also just to sort of track and be a voice for marine and coastal issues in their counties. Mm-hmm. So I had been a member prior to working for Sea Grant of the Clallam County Marine Resources Committee. And then when I started with Sea Grant, I sort of glommed on to the North Pacific Coast Marine Resources Committee. I am an ex officio member, so an employee of the University of Washington, there's a seat for me. I'm a non-voting member. But one of the things that you know I thought would be interesting to try to do when I started with the MRC is just to create a engagement event that mm-hmm. would allow people to connect with the kind of issues that the MRC talks about every time it meets. It meets monthly. Typically, you know, there's conversation about any number of marine and coastal issues. The North Pacific Coast MRC is actually a two-county MRC, so it focuses on the Pacific Coast shorelines of Jefferson and Clallam County together. So it's a joint MRC, which is quite interesting, but does focus on the Pacific Coast only. So the film festival emerged as the right thing to try to do. So we wanted to have an event, an engagement event. I personally have an interest in film as a communications tool. The film festival is very simple. We put a call out for short films. The films that are eligible to be submitted have to be less than 20 minutes. And then they have to be, again, relevant to the natural and social dimensions of the west end of the Olympic Peninsula. That's broad. So we get open film submissions. It's completely free process. There's no cost to submit. We don't pay for films. It's all entirely driven by the interest of filmmakers. So put this call out, get films in, and then basically go through a review process in which we put together a review team, and they basically score the films on really, is it relevant to the natural and social dimensions of the West End of the Olympic Peninsula in some way? And then also, how enjoyable is it, right? Did they enjoy watching it? So they score them, and then we get a ranked list of films, and we ask the filmmakers to give us a film file, and then we put together the film festival based on that. It's historically, I think, always been roughly a two-hour event. We typically show anywhere from, I would say 7 to 10 films get included. Depends on how long any of the individual films are. And they span the gamut from professionally done, well-produced films that are done by professional filmmakers. We've had films included that were made by youth on a cell phone. So it really spans the gamut across the range of possibilities. And that's by design.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, and, it's a fantastic event. It is typically an annual event, although we did have a long break. This year, we are doing it in partnership with the Pacific Coast Salmon Coalition, who runs an event in Forks called Fish and Brew. And so this year, the film festival is designed to be a collaboration with the Fish and Brew Festival, which runs basically all day Saturday, October 3rd.
So, and I you mentioned the website. I do want to put a serious plug out there for the website. Listeners, just Google River and Ocean Film Festival, and it pops right up. I found it a fascinating website with links to people who have participated in the program and links to each of the films for each year. So you could kind of browse there. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, that was the hope, was that over the years, any film that is public, some of the films that we've had submitted aren't online, but in cases where they were, we try to link to them so that we have this kind of running and growing archive of short films that have been accepted into the film festival over the years. It's become quite a cool record.
Ian, this has been fascinating. Do want to repeat, River and Ocean Film Festival. It's in Forks, October 2nd, which is a
Friday.
Okay.
Yep. And so the event will be at the Rainforest Arts Center, the RAC in Forks. Beautiful facility that is donated by the City of Forks every year for the festival. Doors will open at 6:30 and then films will start at 7:30. And it's a 2-hour event. And you can expect, again, probably 7 to 10 short films that we're still in the review process, so we don't know what they'll be for this year. The submitted films were kind of in the same vein as in previous years, just a really nice selection.
Well, I think I will put it on my calendar. Let's quickly hear that mystery sound again. Well, most of you probably know that was the alarm call of a Douglas squirrel. Highly vocal, huge variety of sounds, sharp, high-pitched, repetitive. The alarm call is, of course, a signaling danger from predators or intruders in their territories, like me walking outside my front door, and they can be heard a long way. I want to credit Wikipedia, Parade, and it was recorded here in the Puget Sound region. Again, listeners, thank you so much for listening. If you missed a program, you can find us on your favorite podcast app or on the KPTZ website. Thanks so much for joining us. Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Nora. And we'll have the ending music going out is by Rick Bauer.